on this edition of The Self-Publishing Show.
So we went through that whole process sort of backwards, got it sent off to the publishing house, and it was rejected by them. And their comment was that plain books are for a male readership who have no interest in a woman's story. And I was shocked.
Publishing is changing. No more gatekeepers. No more barriers. No one standing between you and your readers. Do you want to make a living from your writing? Join indie bestseller Mark Dawson and first-time author James Blatch as they shine a light on the secrets of self-publishing success. This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Hello and welcome. It is The Self-Publishing Show with me, James Blatch.
And me, Mark Dawson. Hello.
How are you, Mark Dawson? We're both looking quite bearded. So yours is the proper beard. Mine's just not shaved.
Yes, that's right. Yes, it's winter time. Autumn, winter is coming. Time to grow a beard.
I did have my hair cut this week, makes me look a bit better. And it was a Turkish barber, and they did that thing where they burn your ears. Have you ever had that?
No, I think that you may have a really bad, really bad barber potentially.
It was an interesting haircut where he does this thing that I think people have had it before, and it's a bit of an old man thing because I think it sort of burns off all the wispy hairs that grow around your ears.
Nope.
Which sounds horrible.
I've never heard of that before. Never.
You're going to get it. It's coming your way. But he was also a complete conspiracy theorist. So I had half an hour of this man who's, you know, his family live near Istanbul in Turkey. He's in the UK. And I had everything from how fake COVID is, how people who go into hospital are murdered, because that's the whole point of COVID is to get down the population. Rich celebrities and royalty in the UK drink children's blood. And he's seen the videos of this. So he can't put them online because then he would be killed. It went on and on and on. And I sat there and I did say to him, do you go on the internet a lot in your time? He goes, no, I try not to because, you know, I need to keep myself safe. I mean, absolute.
I'd suggest finding a different barber, to be honest. I wouldn't let him anywhere near my throat with a sharp object.
Well, that's the thing. So Jill said, did you say anything to him? My wife said, did you say anything to him? So, well, no, but he had sharp objects in his hands and he had me over a barrel. So it's strange. Strange that, I mean, it worries me slightly. And I guess this is loosely related to publishing, that anybody can be an author, can't they, of a blog or anything these days. And with that responsibility comes, with that power comes some responsibility. But anyway, so I guess we could put that down to a rambling opening. Right, we are talking nonfiction this week, and we have two authors, two interviews, two authors who come at their writing from a very different place, and that is the world of nonfiction. It's not a bit like fiction. There's a lot of commonality. Nonfiction, two nonfiction authors next to each other can do things differently, but there are obviously common elements, particularly when it comes to self-publishing. So we've got both of them coming up in a moment. Before then, I would like to welcome Virginia Barnhill to our League of Patreon supporters. She's from California in the United States. Virginia, you are very welcome indeed. She's been to patreon.com/self-publishing show to support the show and get some goodies in the process. We do see pictures every now and again of people with their little pins and so on that they get for supporting us. Thank you very much indeed. The one-on-one course is closed for another year. We had a very good set of students coming on. Very excited now as we all knuckle down. We've got a few things to spruce up. MailChimp have done an interesting thing recently, changed their pricing, changed the insides a little bit, just the naming conventions more than anything else. So we'll do a re-record of some of that stuff. And also, I think, basically say to people, think long and hard now before going into MailChimp. Do it with your eyes open because it will start costing you quite a lot of money quite quickly compared to some other mailing service providers. But having said that, Mark, MailChimp has a very strong track record of deliverability. So if you're not as price sensitive in that sense, you think your list is going to grow quickly and be supporting itself, I think that is something you're paying for. You're paying for that deliverability. And they must be one of the best in the business for that. They're certainly one of the oldest.
Yeah, it's always up at the top, towards the top of the list. May not be the number one when you get those deliverability experiments. But that's the main thing with an email service provider. The main thing is not necessarily how it looks or how easy it is to use, although that's certainly something to bear in mind. The main thing is, does it deliver your emails? That should be the first thing that you look at. And I'm not going to, we won't go into a rabbit hole of discussing the pros and cons of all the different service providers, but there are a couple out there that are quite popular in the author space, but don't necessarily offer quite the reliability that MailChimp does. And which, you know, MailChimp has plenty of problems, and, you know, I'm not a fan of continually reinventing themselves, and it is expensive as well. But it gets the emails out there, which is, you know, I'm still with them after a little bit of trying to look around and actually swapping to another platform for a couple of months. But I'm still with MailChimp because the emails have always got to their destinations, which is kind of the point of it.
Yeah, and we were on MailChimp as a business. We moved over to ConvertKit, to Infusionsoft, I should say, for SPF. And I've moved to ConvertKit for my own mailing list, my author mailing list, and also for Fuse Books mailing list. So I think probably it is time to revisit mailing lists on this podcast. It's been a long time since we've done a proper episode devoted to them. So we can flesh that one out for the long winter days ahead of us, and something we can both talk about with some experience. And go through the pros and cons and help people make better decisions. Now, I mentioned Fuse Books. Delighted to say that we have our second author. You might know that Fuse Books is a little indie imprint that Mark and I are running along with Stuart Baish. And we recruited Robert Story, the late Robert Story's books, in February last year. Sorry, this year, I should say. Been running it this year. And didn't destroy a promising career, which is, you know, my big worry about taking this on. We've more than doubled the income, which is the minimum we need to do to make sure that it's been a worthwhile decision by the rights holders, in that case Robert's parents, Maureen and Terry. And we have signed an author, Kerry J. Donovan, and Kerry writes thrillers and crime books in the UK. His thrillers have a very good conceit, I think, about a former Royal Marine who is framed for mass murder for the murder of 83 passengers on a plane. And the real question he's asking himself rather urgently is who's framed him and who wants him dead and the rest of it. So there's a good series of thrillers that Kerry's written, and we are delighted to say, having been through quite an exhaustive process, we've got to this point of signing Kerry and announced that this week. So we'll take on his books for November. And again, I must remember not to destroy someone's career, but to make it better. That's our motto, isn't it?
Don't destroy them, make them better. Yes, I suppose
that'll do. Make them better. Yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because we're both very keen self-publishers. I'm very enthusiastic about self-publishing. You are as well. But we have to accept that there are, so for some people, it's just not for them. They just can't get their head around it. And we've all got perhaps relatives who you help with technology, and for whatever reason, some people struggle, for want of a better word, doing simple tasks. Other people completely take to it. So there's always going to be authors, and I suppose it's quite a big group of authors who just want to write. Kevin J. Anderson said, he's self-publishing now, but in an ideal world, somebody would do all that for him and he would just write. Not everyone enjoys the process as much as you and I do. And there's a range. So that's why we have these indie presses, and why I've been saying for 2 or 3 years on this podcast, I'm very excited about this, because I think this is a really important area of the changing industry.
Yeah, that's right. There's plenty of writers who would just rather do the writing and not do anything else. And for those people, that it is worth looking at the little imprints that are springing up. So certainly not the kind of where you pay someone to publish. That's always a bad idea. But it might not be such a bad idea to look at a smaller imprint run by indies who understand how to do things. And, you know, you've got to do the sums yourself, because, I mean, we're pretty straightforward on the terms. It's 50-50. After, you know, 50-50 net, after costs have come off, and our goal is to make sure we double that. Otherwise, there isn't any point, because the author would be losing money. And we've always been, you know, the stories, we were very clear to them. They were a little bit different in that there was no one looking after those books. So in some ways, we couldn't mess that up, because those books would have faded away without anything being done to them. And obviously you've managed to turn that around, and they're now doing very well. But when it comes to Kerry's books, we need to make sure that we're doubling what he was making by himself. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any point for him to come with us. But, you know, in the event that it doesn't work, we're pretty, you know, there's a fairly generous reversion clause. We wouldn't be interested in working with someone who wasn't happy. So we would hand those books back again, and he could go off and do his own thing again. But hopefully, you know, the aim is that it doesn't come to that.
Yeah, absolutely. When I said double the income, what I mean is double the profit, because actually the income's gone up five or six times since we took it over, but the profit is what needs to double as a minimum. And yeah, I think some of the important differences between us and sort of trad contracts, not only is the generous royalty split, but also the fact that there was a tendency in the trad, they make acquisitions, and you were on the receiving end of this, and make acquisitions, you're the big thing for a few months, and then you're sort of parked, and that's more or less it. They just sit there with no real push behind them anymore. Whereas the way indie, whether it's us or Joffy Books or one of the myriad of indie publishers that are around today, because of the way it's set up, there's a vested interest day to day, week to week, to be working for those books. You can't just let some sit there doing nothing. They will revert back to the author under our clauses and so on. So I think that's a really important distinction for us. Right. Should we move on to our interviews? We've got a couple of things bubbling around in the background. We're not going to mention just yet, but I know 101 is closed. Probably not going to open ads until early 21, maybe January. But we might be doing something between now and Christmas. That's not all I'm going to say at this stage, so stay tuned for that. But let's talk about nonfiction. So we have two authors today, as I say, coming at it from a very different perspective. The first is Mandy Hixon, who caught my eye particularly. You'll know why when I tell you that she was the second Royal Air Force fast jet pilot in the UK. So in fact, as she was becoming interested in flying, the rules changed in the UK to allow women to fly fast jets, and in her case the Royal Air Force Tornado after training on the Hawk. And the book is her story about going through school, through the air cadets, through training. It's an exhausting read, actually, and I don't mean that negatively, because the intensity of that process and living on a knife edge of one check ride away from everything being thrown away for you makes it a very compelling and gripping read. It's a great cover. But she makes her money from speaking as a keynote speaker at conferences and events and such like. And actually, we didn't get into these figures, and I don't know how public she wants to go on them. We had a discussion afterwards. She makes a very good living from this, gets paid really well, and obviously does a fantastic job at it. So for her, the book is more than a calling card. It's done well in its own right. You can see its ranking on KDP. She has self-published it, obviously, but it's part and parcel of her brand. It's something to remember her by, so future bookings come in, an important part when you have something else beyond your fiction, your stories that you write. You have something else you're selling, the role a book can play. So let's hear from Mandy first, and then we've got another nonfiction author after that.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
Mandy Hixon, thank you so much indeed for joining us. I think you may be the first interviewee who's also got an aeroplane behind them.
Yay, success.
So I've got an aeroplane, finally. And you spotted the Vulcan straight away, which most people say is a Concorde. So you're scoring points all over the place.
That's it.
Mandy, you've written a book, self-published your memoir, which is called An Officer, Not a Gentleman. Very impressive title. Mark Dawson was very impressed with the title and the cover, actually. Beautifully designed cover. So I'm going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about the process of somebody who probably doesn't know so much about publishing and would have come into it wanting to write a book and discovering it. So that sort of journey that you've had there. But I'm also interested in your nonfiction business, which I think is motivational speaking.
Yeah.
The role that maybe a book will play in being a kind of calling card for you and so on. So we've got a few things to cover. And I'm going to try my best not to anorak nonstop about flying in the RAF, because I could
don't ask me any technical questions. I'm rubbish.
Probably be here all day with those. But why don't you start by explaining who you are, Mandy?
Okay, so I was the second woman to fly the Tornado GR4 on the front line. I did 17 years in the Air Force in a variety of different roles, and I left in 2011. I joined as a reservist then, so I could continue to fly cadets then. So I continued my flying there for the last 7 years, and I finally hung up my flying boots last year. Around Christmas time, just because life was too busy. I was needed on the side of the football pitches to do a support my children. Since leaving, I retrained in different areas, but actually a real calling for me was, as you said, to get into the speaking world, which I hadn't ever really known about while I was in the Air Force. And my story read really well across to both the corporate sector, but also schools, in fact, anyone, to be honest. And it goes down really well. It can really resonate on lots of different levels.
Yeah. And at some point during that transition from your flying and working life to your second life after that, you decided that a book would be something you either wanted to do, or did somebody say to you, this is a prerequisite for this role?
Well, it's an interesting one. Basically, after I'd finished every single speech, one of the first questions, I always saw a hand go up. I was like, yes, they go, have you written a book? I'd go, no, I can't write. I'm not a writer. And then I started to go, not yet. And the second you say not yet, you open the doors to a world of possibilities. And then with not yet sitting over me, I thought, right, it's time to do it. And I worked in conjunction with a friend of mine who was a journalist as well, an excellent writer. So the two of us worked hand in hand, really. Rob was a BBC journalist. And so basically working hand in hand with him, we compiled the book, came up with it, couldn't come up with the title for years. And it took us about sort of 3.5 years because we got bogged down actually by trying to go down the publishing route.
Yes. Well, that's of course where we come in to chat to you. So we should say this is the book. I think it's a really well-designed cover and title. There we go.
Match
look at
it.
That.
Snap.
Look at that. And it, you know, I've read it cover to cover. I think you learn a lot about you. I'm also interested because I was a BBC journalist and got quite close into the British forces, particularly the RAF, because we've got a lot of those where we are here. And so when I read the book, one or two of the names, I think I knew A.D. Hargreaves. I think I did my PPL with him. He was a navigator with you. So I had a bit of a crossover with that. But it also made me realise the choices you'd made about what to include and what not to include, the tone that you took. And I'm interested in when you write a memoir, who is in your mind as your audience?
And that was the stumbling block, actually, to be honest, James, because I think... when you start to write a memoir, and when I spoke to the publishing, they were like, well, who's it for? And I was like, well, it's for everyone. And they were like, well, that doesn't work. It has to be for a target audience. And I said, but the problem is I speak to a lot of schools, and especially I really wanted to target girls, not over boys, but, you know, to inspire both of them, but just to start thinking outside of the realms of what they think is possible, you know, thinking about careers that aren't just the norm, and to inspire them to sort of just basically dream bigger dreams. And yet at the same time, bizarrely, biggest group of readership has been from perhaps aviation enthusiasts that are really keen on flying, and actually the corporate. So, I mean, I put it on LinkedIn and my sales just went through the roof that day, because of course I've spoken to so many companies and actually they are interested in hearing the story behind it. So, you know what? It was really hard to actually come up with a who is it being written for.
Yeah. And I think it does have an accessibility about it. And perhaps for the people who've done some flying in the past would maybe have liked a chapter that got into detail about how some of the sorties worked in your advanced training. Yeah. And I was sitting there reading the book thinking, but that would kill this book for a lot of people. So that's what's going through my mind about tough decisions and how to pitch it.
It's how you pitch it. I wanted it to be accessible to everybody. So I wanted a teenager to be able to pick it up, but also, I don't know, a 70-year-old lady who was wanting to read a bit more about it. And actually, bizarrely, I've just done a spin class and one of my spin group came up and went, Andy, I've read your book and I loved it. Will you sign it for me? I didn't realise. And she said, oh, I nearly got lost on some of the technical bits.
Oh,
I
really?
Thought, fascinating.
That is interesting.
I try not to put too much technical detail in it, mainly because I'm rubbish on the technical side. But also it's how much you can remember. I mean, we're talking 25 years ago when I joined, and, you know, some of those memories are sort of all molded into one. So, you know, trying to have a really good memory of it is difficult.
Yeah. And did you set out for the book to be a calling card for your business, or was it going to be a revenue generator in its own right? Is that your initial aim?
So basically, pre-COVID, the world was a very different place. So I was, you know, pretty much almost fully booked out with keynote speeches all over the world. My career could not have been going any better. It's a really exciting time. I loved it. I loved the frenetic pace of it. I loved the travel. And I thought, you know what? The book is there basically for businesses to buy, but also for me to sell at the back of the room or just to generate interest in it. And I've had lots of guidance from people that had said, it's fantastic. For conferences, it'll just fly off the shelves. So that was what I was thinking. And then, of course, COVID hit and the whole of that world has changed massively at the moment. And I thought, right, it's down to me now. Because I was self-publishing, I thought, I've got some time on my hands. So why don't I try to get some momentum and interest in it for a book in its own right? And that's what I wanted to do. And that's difficult to do because you're basically just using your networks. You're doing all your own PR.
Yeah. So you did initially think you were going to go down the publishing. What did you know about publishing when you started this? And what did you know about self-publishing?
Nothing at all. And that's why, you know, when some people sort of say, oh, you know, it's a really interesting world. So speaking to a friend, they said, oh, you need a literary agent. So I contacted a literary agent. And the very first literary agent I contacted went, oh, my gosh, this is a fantastic story. Yes. And actually, from one of my speeches, they put me in touch with a major publishing house, someone that was a connection. And she said, I've got this name in. Am I allowed to say the names of the major publishing house?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, in Transworld. So big publishing house. And they said, you know, and they'd be really interested. So when I got the literary agent, they sort of said, Transworld want the first, you know, refusal on this one. So we thought we had a sort of pretty good sort of way of getting into that company. And when it went to them, though, once we then had to come up with a proposal, which seemed a bit retrospective because I've written the book, it was finished, you know. Yeah. And then we were going, okay, so let's write a proposal basically talking about what's going to be in it. I'm like, read the book, you know. So we went through that whole process sort of backwards, got it sent off to the publishing house, and it was rejected by them. And their comment was that plain books are for a male readership who have no interest in a woman's story.
Right.
And I was shocked. I mean, I felt really disappointed in them, actually, because I thought, I think that's rubbish.
Yes.
And I knew that to be rubbish because of the people I speak to. And there's a lot of men I speak to, and they have a lot of interest in a woman's story. So that in itself frustrated me enormously. In fact, I've sort of got quite indignant at that. And then we did get an offer from a very small publishing house. I think it's Bonington's. But it then didn't seem to come to fruition. So in the end, after stagnating for about a year and a half, I just thought, do you know what? Just give me a yes or no, and I'm happy to go alone, happy to self-publish. You know, and would I still be looking for a publisher? Potentially. I'd love to get a hard book, a hardback copy out, and I'd love to see it in shops.
Mm.
So that's the only slight frustration of not going that route.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point because we often talk about what people want out of their publishing experience, and seeing the book on the shelf in a shop is something some people want.
Yeah.
And it, for some very good reasons, and in your case that would work perfectly, raising your profile in a world that your profile is your calling card. Not necessarily the most profitable ways. Shops disc out books and they're expensive to produce and all the rest of it. And I think you've gone down the Amazon fulfillment route looking at the book.
So you've
printed up front.
Yes. Oh, no, print on demand.
It's print on demand, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that's interesting.
It's very odd, actually, going on that route and on the print on demand because, you know, sort of I went to number one in aviation book sales one day and I was like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this. And on Amazon, when I look in my sort of my bookshelf on the Amazon on the website, I'd sold no books. I was like, because there's a delay.
Yes.
Because it's print on demand, obviously, you don't get
So you did go down the self-publishing route, and how did you approach that?
So basically, initially we had the manuscript, the actual book written. So I popped that out to two different proofreaders, one colleagues who I've worked with in the past that have got eagle eyes. We went down that route. We got that done and edited and all the rest of it. Then through local contacts, basically, you know, a friend from the gym, she said, my husband does covers. I was like, great, formatting. And he was brilliant. I mean, the cover, I absolutely love.
Yeah, it's a really good cover.
We had this photo taken, it was for a magazine shoot actually, and I contacted the guy and I said, really love the picture you've got there. Are you happy for me to use it if we you know, obviously give you credit for that in the book? He said, yeah, absolutely, that'd be great. And then basically Burge, for the Burge agency, came up with the cover, and we couldn't decide on a title. You know, that's the really difficult bit. So we had loads of, he must have sent through about 30 different ones with different titles. Break Right was one of the titles mm-hmm. that I thought about. And the other one was Bird's Eye View, which I loved.
Mm.
But I was told not to go for that because it seems quite derogatory towards females. But I was like, but my call sign was Big Bird.
Yeah.
It's a Bird's Eye View. It's seeing it from a pilot's perspective. It's all of those things. They're like, no, don't do it. So one of the chapter titles was An Officer, Not a Gentleman. And we said, well, that actually's got a really good twist to it. And actually so many people said, love the title. It's clever. And I didn't want it to be, I wanted the autobiography to not be a sort of a sexist rant. I did not want that. I wanted just to be a really honest portrayal of what happened. And obviously I've not put everything in by any means because I didn't want that. I wanted it to be positive.
Yeah, but you have put in some of those moments that took your breath away and some even, you know, quite terrifyingly formal moments where you were told in sort of REF formal speak something incredibly sexist that you could do nothing about, and you wander out of the room bewildered and confused, and I really hope those days are over now, but that was a few years ago. But
it was a few years ago, and this is what I've sort of said now is, you know, let's put the caveat on this was 25 years ago when I joined. Now I think the Air Force is a very different place. You've got the Chief of the Air Staff, Mike Wigston, and yes, last year he wrote an incredible, big investigation, and there was the Wigston report basically, which looked into discrimination, bullying, all of these different aspects. And I think it came out quite positive. I think the Air Force is very much, well, all the military, you know, has changed immeasurably from those days. And I hope it continues to grow and expand, you know.
Yeah. So you've got a few people involved in this. You mentioned the Burge agency. What was...
So he was the one that did all the formatting for me.
Gotcha.
Worked for it all. So, yeah. So I just basically picked people, really my own network, to come up with it. And he did all the formatting for me. And it was a little bit of a voyage of discovery for the two of us because he normally sends it off to a publisher and then they do the final bits. But I was going, no, I need you to load it up onto Amazon. He was like, never done that before. So we were sort of doing it together. And he was going, and originally we were like, okay, I'd like it to be colour because there's some photos in it. And I thought, I really want them to be colour. But if you're doing print on demand, you either have to have the whole book in colour.
Yeah.
Or it has to be black and white. So he sort of rang me. I was on the beach. And he said, Mandy, if we do it in colour, it's going to be £24 per book to print. Yeah. And I was like, oh, guess we all need to rethink that one. So, of course, then that changed page width, you know, grams, per, you know, the GSM weighting of the pages, which changed the thickness of the book. So it was a bit of a voyage of discovery for both of us.
Yeah. But then it went up. You made it live. Did you do, was there a launch strategy or any marketing?
Okay, so I always describe myself as an organic grower.
Okay.
so basically the launch was not as I was intending because basically I shouted through to my husband who was in the other room, yay, my book's gone live. At which point he put a post out saying, yay, my wife's book's gone live. And that was my launch.
That was the launch.
Basically, that was the launch, which wasn't quite what I was hoping for in all truth. I then very quickly went, I need to put out an official one now sort of on my page. But up to then, so things to think about are the electric version, so the Kindle version. We'd sort of thought that once we had the PDF of the book, it would simply be a case of slipping it into the Kindle version, and that is not the case. So that was a real awakening for me because we got the paperback up and running and I thought, oh, okay. And I looked at it and suddenly when you start to go through the whole KDP and how you get it onto Amazon as a Kindle, it's a very different story. And you almost have to take your formatting back to that rich text format, a Word document or the like, and then put it all in. And of course, all your formatting's fallen out, everything. And that took me, I personally did that, and that took me quite a lot longer than I thought.
Yeah.
It was quite stressful.
So there is a great program called Vellum, which will you import your Word document and then you can export it into the different formats, and you still want to do some tweaking here and there. So anyway, there's
I just need to get it.
I do know a great podcast you can listen to for all these tips and tricks.
Really?
So yeah,
talk to me. Really known about this beforehand, James.
Talk to me afterwards. Anyway, so but your experience is very typical of people who stumble across the self-publishing world and upload to Amazon and gradually start filling in the blanks on it. I mean, there's, you know, there's no set way to do this. There's lots of gurus out there who have very good ways of doing it. But the result of this, I think, having a quick look at your rankings, is that the book has sold.
Yeah, so it's sold over 2,000 copies now. I have put a major edit out, actually, I'll be honest. I picked up loads of... What's been really nice, actually, was that people contacted me and said, I've noticed a few mistakes. And I was like, please let me know.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
You know, it's
every book has typos in it. I read mainstream published books which have typos in it.
Yeah. So it was great, actually. I put a post out saying, we learn from our mistakes. Please give me feedback. And loads of people on Twitter and LinkedIn went, I've noticed a typo here, or I've noticed that, you know, grammatically that's not right, or you've missed a word here. And that was brilliant. So I did a huge edit where I also made some changes as well. So I actually sort of went through it and just realized, you know, perhaps where I mentioned someone's full name, I just tweaked it and just took out surnames and things. And that was good, actually. But it went to number one in the aviation category on Amazon, which I couldn't believe. So it's sold over 2,000 copies now in 3 months, which apparently is quite good. I have nothing to base that on. So I sort of felt a bit disappointed initially because I thought, wow, I would be selling a lot more. But someone said to me, no, you know, a guy I did a podcast with recently who's written a book as well, and he's very into Formula One world. And Mark said, no, I sold about 1,500 on Amazon, but I've sold 7,500 at conferences. I was like, okay.
But you haven't done any paid advertising for it. You've not any ads or Facebook ads?
No. Actually, wait a minute. I spent £12 but basically on an Instagram. When I was first getting into Instagram and trying to work out how does Instagram even work, very frustratingly. I paid for an ad, which was not even to do with the book, actually. It was just to sort of build a bit of momentum and get some followers in the right areas, which, you know, I was told I had to be on Instagram for the younger generation, for cadets, for university air squadron, and also to try to get into the States with the huge military presence that they have in the States and the fact they really love the veterans side of things over there. But actually, I found the biggest platform for me without a doubt has been two, really. It's LinkedIn and Twitter for me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I would think that Amazon ads might be a good one for you. You can put the book in. Again, there's a podcast you should listen to at some point.
But I will. Now I know about you guys, I will have a look at
it. You know, what's fascinating about this conversation is there's a whole world out there, which I think what you've done so far is a springboard to this book being very successful. And it is already very successful. And I was looking at the rankings, like I say, a lot of people publish memoirs and sell 25 copies.
Right.
you've done really well. And it's definitely got the potential for it. I think it's inspirational on many levels. So let's talk a bit about your other business then, because this is an area, conference speaking is an area that lends itself to lots of different specialisms that people have. In your case, I guess it's motivational. Is that the tagline for you?
Absolutely. So, I mean, when I was first pitched myself, I mean, this one behind me, dream it, believe it, do it sort of thing, that is my motivational side of it. But I do have a very different side, which is sort of experience from the front line. So it's business lessons. So it's, I mean, everyone that comments always says, oh my gosh, that's so inspirational. But there's a lot of business lessons in there, from your empowerment of team, decision-making under pressure, stress, how do we handle, you know, our situational awareness and all of those things read really well across into the corporate world. So, yes, it's a great closing speech for a conference. And that's really where I got pitched. I mean, for October, November and March, I'm almost fully booked every single day. I will be doing a speech somewhere around Europe predominantly.
Wow. Almost every day.
Yeah. I mean, I was probably doing 4, potentially sometimes 5 a week. One week I did 8 in October. two a day. You know, I was like, can I get between there and there in time? So I said, I can do your opening in the morning for you, and I can close your conference for yourself in the afternoon. And sometimes I was flying between Ireland and back and doing a speech sometimes. So, yeah, the most I've ever done was three in one day. That was knackering. Shattered.
And how did you make a start in that field?
So, again, fortuitous chat at a dinner party, telling a story quite drunkenly about being shot at in Iraq, the Break Right story. And a friend at the table said, oh, my gosh, I've got a huge conference coming up at Brockett Hall in Hertfordshire. Can you tell that story? It's all about decision-making under pressure. And I said, yeah, of course I can. Why not? And I just left the Air Force by then. I'd retrained to be an airline pilot and sort of assumed that's the world I was going to go into. But these two children I had just didn't fit into that world as well. And so I did that speech for them. And then basically I went off to a ski chalet and someone said, what do you do? And I said, oh, I'm a keynote speaker, which is hilarious, isn't it? Why not just tell people just what you do, even though you've only done one? And so I just did this and they said, oh, really? Because I run a law firm and we have keynote, you know, speakers to speak. So I went along to their law firm on Blackfriars Bridge, stunning, you know, offices. And I met Miriam Gonzalez there, Nick Clegg's wife. It was a partner in the company, and she was just launching a big charity called Inspiring the Future, about going into schools and creating role models and to get particularly women to go into schools just to talk about their jobs. I got involved in that charity, and then that led to, and I filmed that and sent that out to all the speakers' bureaus. And yeah, to be honest, I was snapped up by most of the big speakers' bureaus in the UK. I think I'm probably on with about 15, maybe more speakers' bureaus now globally. And and it's been really good, actually. Some of them, you know, I get a lot of work through. Others not quite as much, but it's been fantastic, really.
So you film one of your talks and that becomes your kind of audition you send off. That's so how that works.
Yeah, if anyone's wanting to get into that world, you have to have a showreel. If you Google Mandy Hickson now, and a showreel on YouTube, there's a really nice sort of showreel that I've had made with all lots and lots of different speaking clips, a bit of fast jet flying in there. You know, you need some audience sort of footage as well of the audience enjoying the speech so that they can see it's not just you talking. But I mean, that initial one was just me sticking my phone on a tripod and sending that out to the bureaus.
And at these conferences, how many people have books similar to you, are selling them at the back of a hall? How important is a book in that world?
I think it's actually become more and more important. It's almost, it's not just your calling card. I think people expect you to have a book. So, I mean, considering I've been speaking now since 2012, so for 8 years, I haven't had a book. And that has been the most popular question. That I'm always asked is, why haven't you got a book? It would make it's a fantastic story. So why wouldn't you put that down on paper? So a lot of people do have books. I've done a big conference over in Ireland called the Pendulum Summit, and it's a fantastic event. 4,000 people. I would say every single speaker has a book.
Wow.
Apart from me.
Well, you have one now.
I have one now. It's all right.
And on a practical thing, you say this is print on demand, but what do you do in? Presumably you want to take some books with you to the conference.
Yeah. So with Amazon, you can order up to 1,000 copies as an author. But some of the bureaus that I work with also have set themselves up as bookshops. Okay. So if I get a booking through one of the bureaus that has that capability, I'll get them to pre-order books. Or you start to try to sell the book as part of the deal. So yes, Mandy can speak for this fee, but if you would like everyone at the conference, say 300 people, to have a copy of the book, you know, we can do them at this price. So, I mean, it's not, it therefore depends what you're after. Amazon sales, great. Yes, it's lovely to see yourself going in at number one. Fantastic. But ultimately, if I were to sell the books that I only pay £3.84 or something for them, and you're selling it for £10 a book or even a cheaper deal, you're still making the same that you would if you were selling it through Amazon. I haven't quite worked out the logistics of how I'm going to do that, but I think it would probably be getting the business that you're speaking to order them, and then they would be there for you to sign if people get, you know, want them at the back.
Yeah. You then become the in the world of the old sort of traditional publishing organization with physical stock, which is quite challenging in its own way and remaindered at the end of the day. They might say to you, hey, Mandy, what are you going to do with these 35 books? And you think, I've only got hand luggage.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, actually, to be honest. Yeah.
So it's all that. That's their world. That's why the ebooks are really important. The ebooks, for Amazon anyway, is a great way. It's a beautiful cover and beautiful book. It's lovely. And I ordered it because I saw the cover and wanted the hard. I normally read ebook, but I wanted to have this in my hand. But
I'm just recording the audiobook, actually.
You're doing that yourself?
I bought the microphone here, so I was all ready to do it. And then I just, you know what? I was just finding quite stressful working out on the software. And I know there's lots to help you on that. So I downloaded Audacity and the ACX plugin for that to help you do the audiobook. And it was just this whole, what happens if I make a mistake of cutting it? And I thought, do you know what? So I found someone through, again, local networks, and he lives about 20 minutes, 30 minutes away. And so I popped down there yesterday and we recorded half the book. I'm feeling quite jaded today because we got to about chapter 10 with only one re-record of one chapter. So
that's really good. So your own voice, you're doing the VO.
I'm doing all the narration. Yeah. Well, I just thought this is crazy not to, obviously, I could have had Miranda Hart or Joanna Lumley.
Of course.
I thought, actually, I've got a really funny laugh and it's so funny. I put a thing out on Twitter and Facebook and everyone's going, is your laugh in it? I'm going, no, not yet. But I might have to slip my laugh in at some point.
We'll see if we can draw that out. And has this whetted your appetite, Mandy, for a second book? I mean, I'm thinking actually John Nicol and John, the other John, two Johns.
John Peters,
of course, who I've also met actually. They wrote their first non-fiction book and then John Nicol followed that up with a fiction.
He's done loads. I mean, John Nichols is doing fantastically. So he's just, I think it was in May, launched Lancaster. He's written a book called Spitfire. Lancaster, they obviously have Tornado Down. But if you look, John's actually become quite a prolific writer since. I don't think that's me, to be honest. This was a labour of love. It's possibly just the one shot for me. But it's interesting, isn't it? I stopped it deliberately. I just focused on my RAF years. I didn't take it, beyond that really, apart from the very last little bit of the last chapter where I talk about my flying with Emily. But I think I'll probably leave it there for this for now.
I can see there's a fiction series of female fighter pilots. the modern Beagles.
Never say never.
I should ask about Emily actually. Have you kept in touch with her? We should say if you haven't read the book, at the end of the book there's a very sweet little story about her sort of eyes down, and you were slightly thinking this is an air cadet who wasn't really going to engage in the process, and there was a very nervous young girl whose whole life was wrapped into flying, and you recognised you recognised yourself a little bit in that.
I did, and it was a pivotal point for me actually when I flew that trip with her, and I used that in my speech as well. It's how I normally close my speech, and it was interesting because I was talking to my husband and he sort of said to me, maybe you need to drop the Emily story. You've been talking about it for the last 8 years. And I said, okay, I'll certainly have a think about it. And he joined me at a conference in Riga in Latvia. And at the end, I finished with the Emily story. I got a standing ovation. And then they did this word art, the most important thing that they were going to take away from the whole 3 days of conferencing. And the word Emily got bigger and bigger on this screen. And he just went... Yeah, that Emily story really
You know everything I just said.
So unfortunately, I don't know, because you're flying with so many cadets that you don't even know which squadron they were on. I think she was from the Basingstoke area, but I don't know. So I would love to say it, because that would be the fairy tale ending, and the amount of people say, what's happened to Emily? And I go, no, I should just lie.
So there's a picture of her in the book. She needs to identify herself. And, come forward. I mean, hopefully her dream has come true, but who knows?
It's been lovely. On Twitter, there's quite a few young girls that are flying and gaining their PPLs, their private pilot's licenses. And one of them's contacted me and said, I got it yesterday, Mandy. Would you like to come up flying with me? I'm like, absolutely. So we're going to sort that out.
Brilliant. Yeah. So that's the book's place in your world as a speaker. But I think, as you've alluded at, with the sales you've seen so far, there's definitely the potential for this to be a good revenue stream in its own right. But
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then that book on Biggles. Do you have any plans for the future? I mean, you've settled. Hopefully, COVID gets out of the way, and you can get back out there. And is this going to be? So you don't think books are going to be in your future beyond this, Bond? But
probably not. I mean, certainly not at the moment. I would love to actually do a little bit more of a launch. I mean, I know that sounds retrospective, but it would be nice to actually sort of celebrate the fact that I have got this book out there. So I would like to do that at some point. I mean, I'm a trustee of a charity up in London called the Victory Services Club. So I'd love to incorporate something with that. And do something there, hopefully. And I'd like to do the things like literary festivals as well. I'd love, because I'm used to performing, I'm really happy to stand and talk. In fact, I would say that's probably my skill set is doing that. You know, I think that'd be a natural place for me to hopefully go out to some literary festivals as well and do that side of things.
Well, the most important thing you're going to do is prove that early publisher wrong.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Never put me in a box.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, Mandy, well, thank you very much indeed for sharing your experience of writing your first book, and who knows, the first of many.
But, first of many, who knows? But thanks, James, and thanks for inviting me on. It's lovely to chat to you.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There you go, Mandy Hixon. I was being a bit fanboyish, obviously. Very impressive individual, and somebody who, when you read the book, you'll hear what I was alluding to about some of the moments she had as a woman standing in front of some fairly crusty, set in their ways RAF officers, which is really unfair at an early stage in her career, having to battle all that. But she did, came through it, and paved the way for some women after her. So that's Mandy. The next is Mike Capuzzi. Now, Mike works with what he calls Main Street, but you and I would call High Street, but Main Street businesses now, trying to show them the role a book can have in their business. He works, I think, a lot with professionals, so like dentists and doctors in America, who operate in a slightly different way than they do in the UK. But there's almost no business that he says would not benefit from investing, and particularly it's so easy now with self-publishing, investing in a book for your business. So here's Mike.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
So Mike Capuzzi, thank you so much indeed for joining us on The Self-Publishing Show. Great to have you along. You feel like a man with a wealth of experience behind you in the general area of marketing, specifically more recently books, but there's this revolution happening, as you know, in self-publishing, publishing turning itself upside down. And it seems to me you are one of those people who's been able to straddle across quickly and reinvent yourself a little bit from the perhaps more traditional world 20 years ago to the way things are working now. So before we get going and know a little bit about you, your background, why don't you tell me how you feel about what's happening in publishing at the moment?
Yep. Well, very quick background. James is I have an engineering degree, so I was an engineer.
Okay.
So that explains why I sort of take things apart and rebuild. But have been serving clients with my own consulting business since 1998. Worked in corporate America, and then left to start a marketing consulting company, and have been doing that, putting food on my table for my family for the last 22 years now. Used to work with big clients. Now I typically work with what I call Main Street business owners, more of local business owners, small business owners, medium-sized business owners. And actually, I've been publishing books for clients for over 10 years, but very quietly, one-off projects as we've needed them. And what I've seen, at least in my own opinion, is the real need for what I call pithy and powerful content. So many books these days, I believe, are just filled with bloat. And the average person will pick up a book with the best of intentions, and then a chapter or two in, they sort of lose their train of thought and something else pops in, and they never finish it, which I think is a shame. And I've become a real proponent of what I call short, helpful books, Shooks.
Okay.
And it's really just about, James, getting to the point on a very focused idea, a very focused topic, and not bloviating, and really just helping people read the book in about an hour and then go to that next step. So that's sort of the trend that I have seen. Obviously, social media, the internet have really, and all the opportunities for information have really caused people to have much shorter attention spans, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like we have shorter attention spans today. But the flip side of that, which you allude to, is that there's just so much information out there that it doesn't do to spend a lot of time on one person in one area when you know that there's competing areas of information. So I guess the trick, in addition, one thing is adapting the content to that, which is what I guess you're doing here, and then making it stand out. So it can't simply be a case of making it short and pithy. How do people get heard?
Well, I mean, listen, the first thing, and this goes with, you know, again, my background's marketing. So, typically offline, the old school ways, direct mail, in-person type of stuff, but obviously online these days too. And without a doubt, regardless of whatever type of marketing you're working on, a book, whatever it is, lead generation, sales, the first thing is you have to know who you want to talk to, right? So, you know, this idea of everybody should be my customer is obviously an inaccurate thought. So the tighter the focus, James, of who you are trying to talk to, specifically with a book now, who do I want to read this book? What, you know, I always say, what do they look like? And I don't mean physically, but what are their characteristics? What are their, you know, demographics, psychographics, et cetera? So that's the first step. And then once you know who is, it's really about putting a very focused message, a singular topic. There's a great book out there called The One Thing. You know, what's the one thing that your book can be about that's going to attract a small group of people, and that's, you know, not everybody, and really help that person dive deeper into that topic? So in my opinion, I think really knowing who the who is and presenting a very focused concept, a very focused big idea, makes it stand out. Not for everybody, but for that ideal reader.
And do you think that's still a mistake that lots of people make, is trying to be too many things?
Yeah.
Even today. Okay, well, let's explore this a bit more. You talk about Main Street a lot, which I guess we call the high street in the UK because we use slightly different language. But Main Street is traditionally where you nip out and get your stuff, right? So your sort of everyday type of shop. Now, do you think this is a fertile area in the digital environment?
Well, yes, I do. It's not an easy area. Obviously, what's going on in the world right now is even harder. But, I mean, here in America, Main Street has been the backbone. And by Main Street, I don't necessarily mean it has to be a store, but it's typically the local business owner who serves a local community. And I call it, they want to be 5 mile famous, right? They only want to be famous in their community. They want to be the best dentist, the best accountant, you know, whatever, the best gym owner. So it's not critical for them to have a worldwide audience. Some do, but for most people, it's just this 5 mile famous. And yeah, I mean, they all have competition. Very few places just have one dentist, one accountant. So they, you know, the astute business owner, the business owner who, you know, wants to maximize their visibility, their sales, their profitability, they need to figure out ways to stand out. And as you and I both know, being a published author, a self-published author, is still in this day and age one of the most powerful ways you can differentiate yourself. So, yeah.
And you say you started helping people publish books 10 years ago or so. Is that since self-publishing has been an option, or did you go down the traditional route with some people?
No, we've always self-published, James, but the difference being back then. So the first book that I did was in 2007. The first client book I did was in 2008. When I did my first book, which again, we self-published, I had to order 3,000 copies, and I ordered 3,000 copies that I had to go get a truck to go get because I wanted the price point to be a certain price point. So yeah, self-publishing existed then, but it was dramatically different than it is today. I mean, technology, Amazon, all the different services out there have just made it so much easier for people to now, you know, come up with an idea. I have a reader I want to target. I have a good idea, a big idea for that reader. And literally in 30 to 60 days, if not quicker, they can have a printed book in hand. And it doesn't have to be whatever it was, 3,000 copies. It could be as little as one copy if they want to, you know, do that.
Yeah. And what is the role of a book for your Main Street business? And if we expand the definition of that, as you said, it doesn't have to be a hardware store. It can be a digital service even that yeah. serves a specific community. What is the role of a book for them? Yeah.
Well, and let me just clarify. When I say Main Street again, you're right. It's either the person who has that local business, either bricks and mortar or where they go out to someone's, you know, place of business or home. Or like you just said, it's a business owner who serves a Main Street business owner. So I kind of clump them together. So sure. digital marketing agency owner. Well, listen, I'm a voracious reader. I grew up reading. I love books right over here. I have a huge library in my office. And, you know, books have always been seen as objects of value. So I don't need to tell you or your audience this. I mean, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, today, books are seen as objects of value. People typically are used to paying for books. Now, the online stuff has maybe diminished what those numbers are, but they still are used to paying for books. So unlike most marketing content, James, you know, a book is automatically seen differently. No one pays for a brochure. No one pays for a business card. Typically, those things get thrown away. People pay for books. People keep books. And even if they don't read them, they'll keep it, maybe pass it along. So right away, a book, a physical book, all right, a PDF, a Kindle book, not quite the same thing, but have their place. But a physical book, a book that you can literally hand someone, hey, James, here's my book, automatically positions that person differently in the eyes and minds of a prospect, a potential customer, a potential client. That person may not articulate it, but without a doubt, there's something special when you hand someone your book. So because they're seen as objects of value, because people position authors at typically a higher level, you know, it can really be a game changer. And the other thing, just very quickly,
sure.
when you have a book, when you publish, self-publish that first book, and create what I call a book-centric marketing strategy, where it's not about selling your product or services. It's about have a problem, get my book. Have this problem, get my book. Have, you know, want to do this, get my book first. And, you know, making that first step be get my book, and then everything kind of follows after that. That is a more sophisticated, that is a higher and different way of selling. So whoever is marketing and selling that way, automatically is perceived differently than the competition.
So it's almost a brand value raising thing. A book raises the stock that you hold in the eyes of somebody when you have a book.
Yeah. In my opinion, with the people I talk to on a daily basis, without a doubt. And again, I think it's critical for anybody who's listening or watching and who has not published that first book and wants to. And I just talked to someone the other day. They're like, I've been wanting to write a book for 37 years. This is what they told me. I would want to write a book for 37 years. Like, okay, let's do it. Because, you know, again, we'll talk more about this, I'm sure. But, you know, there's this, a lot of people have mental blocks about getting started. But yeah, I mean, you know, who hasn't gone to a book signing? Who hasn't seen gone to an event and seen someone up on stage saying, "Hey, I just wrote a book, and you know, I'll be back in the room, and I'll back in the room, and I'll autograph it for you." I mean, people love that. People love that. And even in this day and age, when there's so much free content out there, a book can really cut through the clutter.
Okay, so let's talk about the shook. Is this a phrase that you've coined, Mike?
Yeah.
This short, helpful book, is that? Okay. So describe I don't know if you have an example, but what's the sort of typical shook? What should we be thinking about in terms of length and content?
Yeah. Well, and a quick marketing lesson, I think it's important. I love helping people kind of see things differently. I mean, first of all, you thank you for bringing that up. I mean, a shook is my brand of a published, printed book. That is a key sort of writer downer, because again, there's a ton of people that do what I do that help people self-publish books and get a book out of themselves. I had to differentiate myself. I had to be different. Much like in the country, in the United States, there's Burger King and McDonald's. They both sell hamburgers, but there's the Whopper and Big Mac. They have their own brand. So just as a little marketing lesson, James, that is why I created my own brand of short, helpful book, The Shook. To differentiate myself. But what we're talking about here is, I mean, we are, and I've got a couple here just to, kind of bring on screen. I mean, these are real books. these are three recent Shooks. I mean, they all have, you know, they sit on my bookshelf. People can read the spine. They're meant to be read in about an hour and a half. My latest one, the 100-page book, would articulate that we're talking about roughly 100 pages, 120 pages. They follow a very specific recipe, a very specific flow, if you will. But really, they're about, on average, 12 to 15,000 words, whereas the typical business book is anywhere from 50 to 75,000 words. Much quicker to write, which is key for us, the authors, much quicker to read and have the reader take action, which is a real game changer that a lot of authors don't think about.
Yeah. And who is there? We talked about Main Street, but is there somebody for whom this isn't the right? Is there anybody left who wouldn't benefit from having a book to their name, a Shook?
Yeah. I mean, it'll sound self-serving, but I cannot think of anybody who, you know, maybe they will not invest the time, energy, and money to work with someone like myself. You know, maybe they read one of my Shooks and go do it themselves. But I can't think of any business owner. I mean, again, pizza shop owner. It may sound odd. How can a pizza shop owner have a Shook? But they could tell about the family history and that the grandmother in Italy, you know, had this recipe. And then here's all our different, you know, and they fill it with testimonials and it's sitting on the thing. And maybe, you know, the only reason they're selling it is to raise money for some special cause that's close and dear to them. But to answer your question, no, I mean, you know, it really comes down to what your goal is, what the goal is of the Shook. And I think any business owner could benefit, or at least maybe take the light off of themselves and help others, right? It's about helping. Yeah. I always call it about helping before selling.
Yeah.
We are good business owners, and good businesses are here to help before we ask for money in return. And a book helps all of that. So yeah, I can't think of anybody who could not benefit by being a self-published author.
And that brings me on to thinking about the commercial side of it, which is obviously in some cases you're adding value to your brand and being helpful, and that will lead to commercial opportunities down the line. In other cases, are there people who can directly make money from a Shook?
Well, yes. But again, with the clients I work with and what I write about, is it's not about the money on the front end, right? So again, traditional publishing, traditional authorship, it's about I sell a $20 book and I get $2. Self-published authors, in some cases, are worried about that. My clients and the people I help, you know, write a Shook and publish a Shook, it's more about the money on the back end by selling their products and services, by, you know, increasing the know, like, and trust factor through a printed book. You can make a couple dollars, but I never, ever want that to be the focus with the clients I work with. It's about helping before selling and then letting the book and the book-centric marketing do the heavy lifting, and hopefully they'll turn into a customer or client.
So if people are turning over in their mind now, you know, they might be a dentist or a mechanic or something, they're thinking, do you know what, writing a book? I mean, I can, first of all, when I thought immediately of dentist and mechanic, when I was trying to think who would benefit, or is there someone who can't benefit from having a book? But actually both of those could. A dentist in particular, I think it would help the dentist to have a more informed patient who understands the process of what's going to go on, what choices they're going to be offered, what options there might be that they don't discuss. All of that could go into a really handy little book that goes into the waiting room. So I'm thinking about somebody listening to this now who might be one of those professions or something unrelated to publishing. How do they get started? Because a lot of people don't consider themselves authors, Mike, do they?
Yeah. And by the way, as soon as we hang up from our call today, I have a call with a dentist who's a prospect. So we work with a lot of dentists. Professional practice owners are sort of like a no-brainer, lawyer, you know, doctor, dentist. But I think the first thing, James, is just like I shared that story of the person who said they wanted to write a book for 37 years, just haven't. I mean, the first thing is a commitment to yourself. I'm going to do it, right? During this whole COVID thing, we've seen a big uptick in people wanting to write their book. They've had more time, whatever. So it's really about the commitment. And again, I always try to challenge folks, don't put it on yourself. Don't think, oh, I got to write a book or it's going to take me forever. It's about serving. If you don't get that book out there for that ideal reader and help him or her or give them the information they're seeking, you are not serving them. So if you can say, listen, I'm willing to commit I'm going to do this by, you know, whatever, 90 days out. And just make that commitment, set a deadline. And again, try to take the spotlight off yourself and what you have to do and put it on your ideal reader and how you're going to serve them. And I think that makes it that much easier to get started.
And do you have a sort of format that people, a formula maybe that somebody who, because literally some people won't know where to start, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, the answer is absolutely. And if it go, that's why I said, you know, in the beginning, I'm an engineer, right? So I'm very detail oriented by degree. I haven't done engineering in 25 years, but yes. So I love to cook. I grew up in an Italian family. So cooking, eating, that's very important to me. My grandmother, my Italian grandmother, had lots of little recipes, which I wish I had kept. I didn't, but I can remember her little recipe cards. And even though she knew how to cook, she followed a recipe. Well, shooks follow a recipe. And you mentioned earlier, they're a direct response type of book. Well, direct response marketing is a different type of marketing. It's about, you know, creating reasons why people should respond. It's not just about getting something out there. It's about putting stuff out there, but asking for a response. So these are direct response books. They ask for a response. They give readers multiple ways to respond. And yes, we follow a very specific formula that I've developed. It's my Big Mac or Whopper type recipe, where we have a very specific flow. And in the case of our clients, they just follow the step-by-step process. They work directly with me. We work together. We get on Zoom calls. We get on phone calls. We mastermind different things, and then they go to the next step. So yeah, it's a step-by-step recipe that, again, can be very simple as long as you just do it.
And do you teach a specific route in publishing, Mike? Because there are different options available today, of course.
Yep. And I don't. We have different options. So typically in our world, James, it's either the business owner who wants to be 5 Mile Famous. So in that case, we're printing their books for them. They're using them in their business, their practice, whatever. Again, we do have clients that have a global audience. So even though they're serving, like for example, software company CEO, I worked with one of those recently. He has a global audience. He can sell his software around the world. He's selling it to Main Street business owners, but he has a worldwide audience. So in that case, we leverage Amazon, all the online opportunities to get his or her shook out there. But it's all self-published. We do not go the traditional, publishing route. Our clients own their content. They're responsible for their content. And it's truly self-publishing, but more in a boutique sense.
So you help people out. You help them get the book out there rather than leave them entirely to themselves.
Yeah. And that's actually an interesting point we can touch on. I mean, the kind of clients I serve definitely have some unique opportunities to get their books out there that are a little bit different than traditional authors. But yeah, we show them all the ways a Main Street type business owners should be leveraging a book.
How big is this area in terms of growth? How many people are thinking about writing a book for the first time at the moment in your experience? Has this changed over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot more people like you and I who are trying to help others. So there's podcasts, and you just have to go to Amazon and see all the, type in self-publishing book, and you'll see all the different opportunities out there. Yeah. I mean, listen, business is not getting easier. There's not less competition. So the astute business owner is looking for ways to differentiate. And again, unlike a lot of things, and I hope to God this doesn't happen. I mean, I've shown examples, James, that are over 100 years old, where local Main Street businesses used a book as a lead generation device. So for the last 100 years, books have worked. The market hasn't gotten that saturated. So I think, the opportunity is still going to be there. And, I think for the business owner who really wants to try to figure out a unique way and have a unique asset that's working for them, publishing and self-publishing a book is smart.
And is this a big part of your consulting business, the book
side? It's actually grown. And again, what's most interesting is we were just serving our clients. And if a client said, hey, Mike, I want to think about something new, we just say, well, listen, how about doing a book? 2 years ago, we started really ramping it up. We actually formed a new venture last year, Bite-Sized Books. And then this year it's just gone, you know, bonkers. And again, we're not trying to be this big publishing company. I'm here on earth to serve certain types of clients. You know, that's what it's all about. Who can I serve and help them get their book done?
And you say, so your clients, you talk about professional, the lawyers and dentists and so on that I mentioned, is that expanding out in your mind to the smaller kind of the flower shop owners? And I'm trying to think in the digital space now, as you say, people helping other companies with their Facebook marketing and that sort of thing, because that's a huge growth area, of course.
Yeah, probably not so much, James. And the reason being, I mean, listen, even if you do it on your own, self-publishing a book, it is a time commitment. It is a money commitment. I mean, if you're doing everything on yourself, it's not as big as working with a publishing company. But it's a commitment. And for a smaller transactional business, a flower shop, pizza shop, even though I could still see them doing something, by the way, my daughter, who was a senior in high school, published a book and raised a lot of money with that book. So it doesn't, again, there's other reasons why you can, you know, publish a book. But I think for the smaller, more transactional businesses, those business owners are more focused on, you know, more digital marketing opportunities, Facebook. I think it feels like it's a quicker way to get people's attention.
So what are the other options? What would go alongside a Shook? Because presumably it's not going to be the single plank in a strategy.
Yeah, no, and it shouldn't. And we always say, listen, I mean, people don't like to hear this necessarily, but, you know, believe it or not, writing and self-publishing and getting the book printed and all that good stuff, designed and printed, that's the easy part, really. The harder part is being committed and being disciplined to use it on a regular basis and to have different avenues of opportunity for people to get your book. And then the follow-up even after that. So, no, it's really just a prong and a multi-prong approach. But we always say there's before Shook, with Shook, and after Shook marketing. And each of those has a number of, you know, things you ought to be doing to get the book in someone's hand. And then when you send it or they get it, so what goes with it? And then afterwards, the follow-up. I mean, that's, you know, the money's in the follow-up. So, there's multiple strategies.
Now, is there anything here for the fiction author? I don't know if any of your clients come to you and say, I've got a book in me, I think it's a romance. Or science fiction. This is not the area, presumably, you're focused on.
No. I have yet to write a fictional book, even though I think it would be kind of cool to do that. I have yet to do that myself. Now, these are marketing and sales tools, James. Yeah. That's what I help business owners with.
Yeah, and we do know that the book is now, as you say, it's adding value to who you are, whether ultimately your revenue stream is going to come from conference appearances or something like that. The book is an important part of that. But I wonder, do you think we'll get to a saturation point if everyone's producing Shooks, or is this still only a small percentage of getting this?
Well, in my head, I worry about that kind of stuff because we've seen how online marketing has been prostituted, right? I mean, we've seen over and over again. I can remember I started using webinars back in 2004. I mean, I was one of the first, wow. You know, I had a GoToWebinar account way back in 2004. And I actually created a course in like 2009 on how to use webinars, and there was nothing out there at the time. Now, you know, everyone has webinar stuff or Zoom stuff now. So we have seen marketers saturate the opportunities that are out there. I mean, listen, go to Amazon, go to BNN.com, whatever. And yeah, there's multiple books on most topics. The differentiation point though, James, is there's only one of you. There's only one of me. And by articulating in that through the written word, our own philosophies, our own beliefs, getting people to know, like, and trust us through our written word, you know, that'll always be unique. So there's always going to be unique people that you can serve that get what you do. And I think if given that being the case, and really, you know, following good direct response principles of being highly focused and knowing your reader and all that, I don't think we're anywhere near saturation point.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And do you think there's a reverse benefit here? Do you see this in your clients in that once they committed to writing the book, or the Shook, they've put stuff down that it then helps them organize themselves in their mind and feeds back into the way they operate their business?
Yeah. You must have read one of my books. I say that exactly. It's an amazing benefit, James. And it's one I've reaped over and over. So when you are intentional like that, when you get focused, and this is why I love it, even though we offer ghostwriting and all that, I'm not a big fan of it. I'd rather get clients to sit there and think along with my help. But there's a hidden benefit that comes from that. And amazing things can bubble up when they start logically thinking about things, seeing new opportunities a different way. I just worked with a young guy. He's still in the military. He's a fighter pilot. He's an F-16 fighter pilot. Very cool guy. And he has a business, also in a real estate investing business. And when he now, since we worked on his first show, he's now published like 3 or 4. But the stuff that arose from him writing the book was so beneficial to his business. He redid everything, his website, his messaging, because he finally got clarity because he just focused on exactly one type of person with one specific message.
Wow. I don't know what it is about F-16 pilots. We've got two in our community I can think of. These are driven people though, aren't they? They've obviously worked hard to be where they are, and they, towards the end of their flying career, start to think about what's next, and they want to get that bit right as well. Yeah. So we can learn a lot from them. Okay, Mike, so what's the one thing people should take away from this interview?
Well, listen, I would say at minimum, it's that if you think a book and being a published book author can help others and help you and yourself, by all means, do it. This podcast, other podcasts, you know, there's so many opportunities to learn how to do this. That should not be the stumbling block. Just do it. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but people want your information. They want what you have. And a book could be the ideal medium to give it to them.
Do you find yourself having to inject a bit of confidence in people who might lack that, not quite believe that they've got something of value?
Sometimes, for sure. Again, most of the folks that follow me and want to do this, they're already in the mindset. They're typically, you know, well within this, you know, the stream of, you know, I get a book will help me. But yeah, I mean, there's folks that definitely need that self-belief and that confidence. I mean, again, my daughter is a case in point. And again, if you just break it down into bite-sized chunks and just tackle each chunk at a time, the task of writing a book is a lot less daunting.
Yeah. So by the time they come to you, they are probably in that mindset. But the people listening to this podcast may be those people who don't realize that there is a value to them putting down what they know and what they can teach others.
Yep.
Great. Mike, I can't remember if there's a giveaway or something we can give people, or a PDF or so that we can help people along the way if they're thinking about this.
Well, thank you. And if, with your permission, I'll share. I have a couple gifts, James, I've put together for your listeners. One of my Shooks is called Main Street Author. And this is really more a book about how local business owners use Shooks. It's not the how-to book some of my other ones are, but if they go to mikecapuzzi.com/gifts, that's plural, gifts, I'll send them a link where they can actually read this online. So they don't even have to buy it. They can read it online. I'll also send the audio version. We didn't talk about that, but audiobooks are becoming bigger. So I'll send them the audio book so they can listen to it. And then I've created, you know, I talk about these building blocks and step by step. I've created something called the Shook Building Blocks. And you print these off. They're like little cards that you can literally build, you know, how to build your Shook. So I'll give them a copy of that. So those three gifts, if they go to mikecapuzzi.com/gifts.
Superb. Well, Mike, thank you very much indeed for taking some time out of your day. Good luck with the dentist who's coming up.
All right, James.
I'm sure he or she will benefit.
Yeah, thank you very much.
This is The Self-Publishing Show. There's never been a better time to be a writer.
There you go. This is something we talk about quite a lot amongst ourselves, Mark. You and I have talked about the 101 course in particular being something that's very large parts of it, very relevant to marketing a book for the non-fiction author as well as fiction authors.
Yeah, well, the courses, both the Ads for Authors course and 101, they're both about book selling. That's the end of the day, different, approaching it from different angles. You need, you know, kind of both of those working together, but it's all about book sales. So why wouldn't it work for fiction and nonfiction? It's just the same as the product at the end of the day is just the same. And the methods you use to sell it are the same too. So yeah, no reason why it wouldn't work.
And I guess this is some, a few years ago, these big speakers, motivational speakers, they all had books, and they're often, you know, Victor Kiam or whoever, they were huge sellers in the business world. Now that's a market that's become very, very big. I mean, it's a $1 billion industry, just that nonfiction, self-improvement, managerial tips. Who's the big guy who does the
Well, there's Stephen R. Carey. He does the 10 Habits of Highly Effective People. There's Tony Robbins.
You know, I was thinking of, yeah.
I could go on and on and on about the number of people in that space who have those kinds of books. It's more than $1 billion, a multi-billion dollar industry, self-improvement, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and more than just the book itself being a big part of their income, it's still, we would say, an important part of your brand and your calling card. And as Mandy is finding out when she goes to events and has the book at the back of the hall, people remember her, they learn more about her, know more about her, and that's got to be great for her future real world bookings for speaking and so on. So, right, that's nonfiction. We do talk about fiction a lot, so I'm really pleased we've had an episode devoted to nonfiction. And I hope whether you're writing thrillers, romance, paranormal romance, or nonfiction, that's been relevant to you both those interviews today. Mark, you need to get down the range and practice a bit more your golf. You and I are both suddenly playing golf because we've become middle-aged. Is that what happened here?
I think something like that. Yeah, a bit of a crisis going on.
Yeah, a bit of a crisis. Gets us out of the house, though, doesn't it?
That's true, yeah. Although, it was quite. I played on Saturday. It was quite nice, but it did get dark quite early. So, yeah, that's autumn for you.
I can't wait to the SPF Open next year.
It'll just be me and you, but that's you know, we have to get John. I'm not sure if John has ever played golf in his life, but that's
he can caddy. He can be my
probably
caddy.
He could do. Yes.
Yeah. And there's lots of golfers in SPF. Ernie Dempsey's a very good golfer. I've played a little bit of golf at the range with him. Good. Okay, look, that's us. That's this week. We will be back next week. We have a good lineup. In fact, I was looking at it just today. The interview's coming up in the future. We've had a very busy period of recording interviews, and we're now reaping the rewards of that. So the next few weeks are going to be awesome as we go above and beyond 2 million downloads for this show. Thank you very much indeed for being a part of that. That's it. All that remains for me to say is it's a goodbye from him
and a goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Get show notes, the podcast archive, and free resources to boost your writing career at selfpublishingshow.com. Join our thriving Facebook group at selfpublishingshow.com/Facebook. Support the show at patreon.com/selfpublishingshow. And join us next week for more help and inspiration so that you can make your mark as a successful indie author. Publishing is changing, so get your words into the world and join the revolution with the Self-Publishing Show.